you, John.
A little over a year, Fred.
Yeah, and he's been in the newspaper and public relations business for lowly many years. And I think by his own admission, the story he had relative to the unidentified flying object was probably the highlight of the things he's written so far. And I hope you are cognizant of the three episodes which have appeared, and the fourth, and the fifth one is in the edition which is now, or should be very soon, on the street. Is that correct? I saw a preview of it a little bit ago, and in it, John, as far as the hills of New Hampshire from Portsmouth, I believe the Air Force said that it is not going to take any further examination of this, and as far as it, the Air Force is concerned, the case is closed. Is that true?
Well, they've said in words of one syllable, Fred, we are not interested, period.
Have you tried to dig a little further into the Air Force reaction, why they take that stand, or is that a closed door that just you can't penetrate?
Well, it isn't as much a closed door as getting a swerve. There are many, many people who feel that the Air Force is no more than window dressing, that, in fact, the Central Intelligence Agency is actively investigating all of these confirmed sightings that the Air Force superficially can't explain.
And in a quick recap for people who may not be familiar with this, John has written this series on a couple from Portsmouth, New Hampshire, who, according to the story, would you tell us, John, you wrote it?
Let's see if I remember it. This involves a couple by the name of Bonnie and Betty Hill, who are outstanding and upstanding citizens in their community in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. On the night of September 19th to 20th, spanning midnight of 1961, they were driving home from Montreal to Portsmouth by way of Franconian Arch, New Hampshire, on Route 3. This story is divided now into three basic parts. First, the initial sighting of an unidentified flying object. Its actions, its maneuvering in the sky, so captivated them that they stopped, got out of their car, looked for some several minutes, decided they had enough, got back into the car, and proceeded again en route home. Several minutes and several miles later, they were aware of this very same object now hovering directly over their car as their car continued in motion. They stopped the car again and got out, and this time took with them binoculars that were on the front seat and which they had taken along for vacation purposes in Canada. They looked through the binoculars and saw this object hovering perhaps 100 feet above their car to one side of the road.
Apparently staring at them.
That's right. And the Hills, of course, through the binoculars, stared back and saw movement aboard the spaceship, life. And I say spaceship in quotes. I don't know any more than you do whether or not this was a spaceship.
What they thought,
whatever it was, they saw humanoids through the dual row of glass windows. Now, this sight so unnerved them, particularly Mr. Hill, they now got into their car and sped away for what they thought was their own lives. Another 10 minutes, perhaps, and several miles down the road, they rounded a curve to the left, and that car inexplicably just stopped and rolled to a complete halt. And there, alongside the road, at ground level, was this immense, intense orange glow. And several men, dressed in rather strange uniforms, much like motorcyclists, were lined across the road. These people tried to stop their car to drive around them to, as they say, to get the heck out of there. The car wouldn't start. These men came over, removed them from the car, escorted them to the source of this light in the woods, and they were taken aboard what purported to be a spaceship. For the next 2 hours, they were submitted to a complete physical and intellectual examination, question, life on Earth. The questioners themselves seem to be very unfamiliar with the very basics of our existence.
But they did speak English, didn't they?
Once, but one question. And again, there is, for purposes of writing, we say spoke English. There is no evidence that there were words exchanged, and if it occurred, it might have occurred via a telepathic communication.
Mm-hmm.
But for the next 2 hours, these people were utterly removed from this earth, not physically, but they just entered another world the moment they entered that spaceship. After the examination was complete, the leader of this group told us, the Hills, that they would never ever remember what happened. And they didn't. They didn't until some several months afterwards, when Mrs. Hill began to experience a succession of dreams so horrendous that they began affecting her waking hours. And she told her husband about the dreams, and these, the mention of what she saw, as disjointed, as disconnected as it was, began now to stimulate things in his subconscious. They both went to a psychiatrist in New Hampshire. The psychiatrist offered as much help as he could, but apparently he was just unsuccessful at getting to the root of whatever this problem was. So he arranged for them to come here to Boston, to the offices of a rather eminent and quite professional psychohypnotist. And it required another 7 or 8 months of hypnotic therapy. But under hypnosis, these people were able to give a very, very graphic account of what they say happened aboard the ship, relating conversations, relating little things that one wouldn't ordinarily remember. For instance, in yesterday's installment, we recall how at one point several of the occupants of the ship ran excitedly into the room where Mrs. Hill was being examined. And one of them asked for her to open her mouth, and they began tugging at her teeth. And she said, in effect, "What are you doing?" And what had happened was that minutes earlier, while Mr. Hill was being examined separately, it was discovered that he had false teeth, and they had never encountered anything like this before.
They were stunned beyond words.
Absolutely.
Well, that happens, I presume, to many a person who isn't involved in anything as exciting as the Hill story, the business of suddenly discovering someone with a set of artificial teeth. And it isn't half as exciting, perhaps, as the time that you get caught without any money. And John will talk on money for a moment and then return to what happened after that. John, you must have run into the situation that people, whether they be ill to somebody else, and go through an encounter like this, are entitled to some consideration of privacy. And yet, how do you, what was your reaction? How did you approach the thing? With what thought?
Well, it was my thought, and then, of course, it was also reflected in the ultimate decision of the Boston Traveler, that certainly these people deserved every single consideration. But then, where do you draw the line between maintaining a certain degree of personal privacy or the public's right to know?
That would be a big one to answer. Don't ask me.
And in making this decision, it had to be made abundantly clear to all of the readers that, number one, the Hills themselves did not initiate this with the Boston Traveler. In fact, even though they have received me very, very cordially, have talked to me at great length, they have not chosen to talk about any of the incidents at all.
Well, then, you've had to use the best knowledge and know-how and the tools of your trade as a fine reporter to dig all this out to run this 5 series, I would imagine.
The digging alone consumed well over 2 months.
Is that so?
The writing took another month.
And how long, now that this series has concluded or will conclude today, this doesn't necessarily end your interest in it, I'm sure.
No, not at all.
And how has the public's interest been generated, John?
Apparently, from what we're told of the traveler, this series has received a fantastic response, not only in newspaper sales, but the hundreds of people who have called the traveler. And you know, as well as I do, being in the business I was once in, that it takes a lot to get people either to sit down and write a two-penny postcard or to pick up the phone and dial.
Right.
And in this case, people were saying, you know, wonderful, fantastic. Not that we believe now any more in UFOs than we ever did. But the story is so compelling, we feel that we have to read it.
And extremely creditable. You know, for the benefit of people who may not have caught perhaps the first or second, or may not have heard about the series until right now, is there a possibility that this series will be run again, or perhaps all five of the episodes in one Sunday edition or something? Because it's so great, I hate to think of anyone missing it.
I don't know what management's plans are. It would be nice, because I know that there are many, many people who've tried to go out and buy a copy of the Boston Traveler at night upon hearing of this, and the newsstands are just cleaned out.
Maybe they can get it on back issues.
I think they can if they get a hold of our circulation department.
And the thing is, now that it's done and the story is completed, are you in a position to give your own personal feeling about the entire situation? Do you believe it?
Well, that is the question most commonly asked of me during the course of this series. Do I believe it? And I don't know whether I believe it or not. And I don't think really it's important whether or not I believe it. I think my function is, number one, to unearth the facts, as Jack Webb used to say, to present them in as objective and as well-balanced a manner as possible, and let the readers decide for themselves, because I am not a scientific person. I can't make these determinations. But people do have minds of their own. They've been seeing things now in the skies for years and years. And what they see is there. Perhaps there is a very plausible explanation for what they see.
Well, I certainly have taken an interest, and I'm a great and an imaginative. I have a great imagination, and have been fascinated by this whole business of the unidentified flying object. But nothing has captivated me like this series of stories that you had running this week in The Traveler. And I can't say enough to urge everybody who has an iota of interest to go out and make an effort, if you have to borrow it from a neighbor, to read it, because it will really get you to the point where I think maybe a wave of public demand will be such that perhaps the Pentagon will have to change its thinking and come forward with something. Meanwhile, to you, John Utrell, congratulations on a very fascinating article, and thanks very much for stopping in here long enough to go a little more into detail on it.
Well, thanks so much, Fred. Now, if I could only do something about these little green men on my roof.